Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to learn how a study at Osaka City University School of Medicine in Japan showed that coenzyme Q10 provides relief for fatigue. And this was a double-blind, randomized, placebo-controlled study. It wasn't a lot of coenzyme Q10, just 150 milligrams. It was over a 12-week period. So we'll talk about that. I have a lot of really good studies, always in peer-reviewed journals, and always done in mainstream science, but never reported in mainstream media, and hence never used by mainstream doctors. That's the irony. Now think of that for a moment. On the one hand, we say only trust real science and real medical applications that have been proven and published. Good. That's all we do. But then when we do it, they don't use it. That's the hypocrisy. And they didn't intend to use it anyhow. So you have the benefit of being way ahead of this curve. Also today, I've written an editorial about why we should stop and think before we make unilateral decisions to deface or destroy, even now book burnings, anyone that is associated with what we would consider racist views or racist actions from the past. Because mine is a little different perspective. Some people certainly deserve not to have a statue because of what they've done, but others you better look at in balance. Also, here's this. Have we taken into account anywhere, at any time, how these individuals were raised? For example, George Washington. And what the culture was. Now, if you don't think that's important, imagine how our own culture has shifted its values in the last 20 years, and then 20 years before that, and 20 years before that. About every generation, more or less, has a challenge to the preceding generation or generation's values and views and perceptions. So we're acting as if all life started today, when we have suddenly awoke, as if nothing from the past matters, and yet I can take every single person on this planet and show them, based upon what they have believed and what they have done, even with the best of intentions, they were wrong. So if we're looking for perfect people to emulate, you're going to have to live completely in illusion, because none exist today and none have ever existed, no matter what we may consider to the contrary. So I'm asking for the adults in the room, those who have a concept of reason before you react, instead of everyone who's reacting without reason. So my commentary should be of interest to you. Also, I have a commentary today on the psychology of obedience and the virtue of disobedience. Also, we're going to hear from another nurse. She's on the street in front of the Capitol in Ottawa, and she's challenging what we're being told about the COVID virus. She's very well educated. She's been a nurse all over the world, Israel and Ukraine and Italy, etc. And she's laying out some of what she has observed and what she has done by studying the scientific literature. It's not the easiest thing to hear because there's a lot of background noise. It's a rally. It's outside. But I thought it was of value to have it. Also, Jordan Peterson predicts the riots to come. And why? I thought it was interesting. I'm sharing that with you. And we have more and more people who are listening from different places around the United States. They can't be near a radio and hear us on some land-based station. They're listening over the archives. Please write down our archival number, because one phone call, you can download five different programs to listen to. Our archive number is 701-719-9976, 701-719-9976. If you don't have a chance to get online, let's say you're listening at night, well, clearly you can't call in live, but you can call our voicemail and leave a question or an opinion. Our talkback line that you can leave a message on is 862-800-6805, 862-800-6805. And that's for people who would like to share their opinion. And we've got a lot of very insightful people in this audience who are sensitized to the issues at hand, and I really appreciate when you call in and share your points of view. Now, let's go to the latest on healing. One of the single most important, one of your top 10 nutrients, in fact, every day is you should consume is coenzyme Q10. I've given a lot of information how it helps energize the heart. It increases the energy in the mitochondria. That's good because your heart and your brain are the two organs in the body. The heart's a muscle that pumps so much, especially if you're exercising, that it needs to replace its energy. And the older people get, the less energy they're consuming that can help the body, so the body slows down, the brain slows down. So coenzyme Q10 protects that. A better brain when you're taking coenzyme Q10. Also, you're less likely to have a heart attack or stroke. Now, this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrients, and what it says is this. They enrolled a group of people, 20 to 64, who had experienced fatigue during their daily lives each day for at least a month. And so what they did, they gave one group 100 milligrams and another group 150. And they gave the 100 milligrams of ubiquinone. Now, that's the original form of coenzyme Q10, which breaks down into ubiquinol. And then they gave a placebo. And what they found was that after a month, those taking had a substantial relief in fatigue. So think of all the people who have chronic fatigue syndrome, who have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, which are tens of millions in the United States from all the sugar and fructose they've consumed, those who suffer from any form of neurological inabilities such as multiple sclerosis, ALS, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. That would help all of you. So this is why this study is very important. By the way, it was a 12-week study. From Rimet University in Australia comes a study that says Chinese herbal medicine can improve memory and cognition. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal, the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine. Now, this was they were only using 19 studies that were double-blind, placebo-controlled. And here's what they found. You might want to take note of this. So if you have any form of mental memory or cognitive problems, this might be able to help you. Ginkgo biloba. Ginkgo biloba helps improve concentration and revitalizes the brain by improving blood flow to it. Hawthorn berries, known for their antioxidant properties, hawthorn berries can strengthen your blood vessels and remove toxins and boost cognitive performance. Ginseng, Panax ginseng, P-A-N-A-X, or what's called Asian ginseng, it's known not only for boosting energy, but also for stimulating mental acuity and activity. Rosemary, by the way, you're seeing more and more rosemary brain tonics. It depends upon how much rosemary they're using in those tonics. But if you made your own, you could make it more concentrated, and that really enhances mental clarity and recall. Go to Gotukala, G-O-T-U-K-O-L-A. It's considered a cooling herb. It promotes circulation, it enhances memory, and promotes longevity. Lemon balm, well known for its calming effect, lemon balm is a sleep aid that also improves memory and cognition. And Chinese skull cap. Skull, S-K-U-L-L, cap, C-A-P, one word. It's used to detoxify the brain and strengthen the nerves for better brain performance. So these have been around a long time, and that's good. I remember a person coming in one day to the Tri-State Healing Center. And we had an open-door policy. Anybody could come in, and we invited doctors, nurses, scientists to come in to see what we were doing. And if they found value or virtue in what we were doing, maybe they could take it and do it themselves. Well, this guy came in, and I remember he had to duck to get in my door. And he was tall. I never asked him how tall he was. He could have been 6'10". Anyhow, He comes in, kind of a thin guy, and he says, do you have a moment? I said, sure, sit down. So he sits down and he says, you know, I've been hearing about this place for several years. I said, where are you from? He said, well, I'm from Los Angeles. And I said, why are you here? What brought you here? He said, well, work this way. I have HIV, but I had no symptoms. And so I went to an HIV support group, and we had a lot of people, several hundred. We held it in a classroom. There were so many of us, or in an auditorium of a school. And he said, but over the last 3 years, virtually everyone in each of my health support groups has died. And I'd gone away for a couple months to work with a program that was being sponsored by Louise Hay out there on meditation and mindfulness, helping to keep you de-stressed. And as we know, being highly stressed, thinking you're going to die, and soon, and making you a pariah, frequently by your family and friends, or at least the people in society, I just needed a break from all this, because the main thing they were advocating were these guys were there really almost like salespeople, though they weren't selling the drugs, but they kept, you got to take this DDDI and DDC and protease inhibitors and AZT, all of them. And we were being inundated with all these drugs we had to take, and people were taking them. And you could see the more drugs they took, the sicker they got, the more drugs they took until they died. So he said that he went away for 2 months and felt terrific, came back, and all the people in that last support group that he was in had passed. He said, that's it. And I said, well, if you've heard about this place for years, why didn't you come earlier? And he said, well, because every time I'd mention your name, some of these guys would freak out. Oh, that's all quackery. And yet there were people who were talking about how their friends were getting treated and their conditions reversed, and no sicknesses, no Kaposi sarcoma, no pneumocystis, no thrush, none of this stuff. So I just had to come and see for myself. I said, well, take your time. It was in the late afternoon. I said, our AIDS protocol starts at 5 o'clock in rodents till midnight, 7 nights a week. So we have lots of people, and go in and talk with them. We have nurses and physicians, talk with them. If you want to see patient records with the patient's permission, then ask the patient, and then go over it with them. They'll show you how every one of their blood chemistries from Roche Labs shows they're improving. And I didn't, that was it. I see people every single day, dozens. So evidently he started. I saw him in there a couple times getting his vitamin C drip. And about a year later, he had zero converted. And it was interesting because he said he was going to go back to California and prove this. I said, no, you go back to California and you start talking about natural therapies, you will be vilified and you'll be destroyed. No, best just leave it be until such time that the AIDS community is open to alternative approaches to the condition. Right now, there's only one approach, that's pharmaceutical. And even though most people are dying not from HIV, but from comorbidities, and frequently due to the medication and destruction of their immune system, they're not ready for that message. Too much money is being made. And that's the truth of it. Nobody wants to hear that story. But when one of the things I gave him on his protocol was coconut oil. And he said, what's this? I said, it's coconut oil. He said, why should I take coconut oil? I said, well, because there's strong antiviral properties in coconut oil. You're taking about a tablespoon. And I explained how in the history of Ayurvedic medicine, which is over 4,000 years, they have recognized coconut oil as a powerful natural medicine. And coconut oil has strong antiviral and antibacterial properties. And you don't have to take a lot of it, but it really works. And so everybody, every single person, all 1,200 people who had AIDS, HIV infection, were taking as part, they were also taking bitter melon, a lot of other things, but that was one of the things that we knew was working. Okay, jump forward. Today, from the Lavati Hospital and Research Center in India, big complex. Quote, Doctors rediscover coconut oil's 4,000-year history in natural medicine, including destroying viruses. Quote, the lead author of a study, a Dr. Shashank Joshi, dean of the Indian College of Physicians, a endocrinologist, and the Lavati Hospital for Research Center, Embatia Hospital in Mumbai, and Maharishi, all together, were studying coconut oil. And what they found is this. This is their study abstract. It was published, quote, coconut oil as a healthy oil was recognized in Ayurvedic medicine almost 4,000 years ago. The same health effects were also attributed to the mother's breast milk. In ancient literature, modern research has now found a common link between these two natural health products. Their lipid content, the medium-chain fatty acids and monoglycerides found primarily in coconut oil, have miraculous healing power, which act as natural antibiotic and also help modulate immunity. The information discussed in this review explains that coconut oil, either topically, meaning on your skin, or applied or ingested, gets broken down to release lauric acid, L-A-U-R-I-C, and monolaurin, known as an antimicrobial agent. And then it goes on to talk about the studies reported in literature also discussed to evaluate the antiviral and antibacterial and antifungal benefits of coconut oil. Not only does coconut oil metabolites have antimicrobial activity, but also these remarkable derivatives have been shown not to cause resistant organisms to appear. That's good. Now I'm going to skip down to the bottom because this is what's really interesting. From the study, quote, I'll bet no one in this audience knows this. The first clinical trial using coconut oil and monolaurin, 800 milligrams daily, against HIV/AIDS was conducted in the Philippines. The study involved 15 HIV patients aged 22 to 38, 5 males, 10 females, for 6 months. There was only one fatality, and 11 of the patients showed higher CD4 and CD8 counts after 6 months. In another study, HIV subjects with CD4 T lymphocyte counts less than 200 cells per M were divided into a group that received a placebo or coconut oil. After 6 weeks, the coconut oil group shows significantly higher levels of CD4 and T lymphocyte counts versus controls. And they conclude, seeing physicians in India return to their Ayurvedic natural medicine roots is very positive. If they can band together and fight against the global pharmaceutical cartel operated through the World Health Organization, they will have a better chance at resisting, you know, those who only want a pharmaceutical approach. Okay. So what we were doing, for those of you in this audience who were part, who had HIV and AIDS, and who were there, not a single patient died. That's 1,200 people and 15 seroconverted. Their whole stories, the proof that we were the first in the world to reverse HIV and AIDS completely and scientifically documented, all the medical records, all the lab reports, it's part of a new documentary, brand new documentary. It's 2 hours and 44 minutes. You see this documentary free of charge by going to prn.fm and go down on the left-hand side. You'll see that 2 hour and 44 minute documentary. It's also been posted on YouTube. Now, you wouldn't know that because the people out there don't want you to know that because it's a huge financial benefit to sell people drugs, not natural approaches. But now you know. The evidence is there. From MedPage, this is a study about quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. When you eat an apple, in the skin, quercetin. An onion, lots of quercetin. Well, quercetin is a plant flavonoid. Now, you can find it in green tea, and it's being eyed by some as a potential adjuvant therapy for COVID-19. But whether quercetin will ultimately be used or not, well, that's up to the individual physicians. I'm just saying that the scientific literature shows its strong antiviral activity. In fact, in that same documentary, you will see an interview filmed by Dr. Jawala, the chief virologist at the Linus Pauling Institute, And he says that they were able to destroy all their HIV with quercetin. And then they destroyed it with vitamin C and quercetin and vitamin C together. That's why when I came back from visiting Dr. Jawala, I started incorporating a lot of quercetin orally every day when people were taking their vitamin C, the two together, vitamin C and quercetin. And it used to be half to half, but now I do same to same. Phenomenal antiviral activity. So I believe people should be using it for all viruses. In any case, and by the way, I'm still working with people with HIV and AIDS and still getting success. It's just that these are stories that people don't want to hear. And of course, they have Wikipedia to try to deny all this. Monday, a big story coming to you on Wikipedia. They lost a big suit in Germany yesterday. So I'll tell you about that. But wait till our suits hit. And now our story is ready to be presented. In our suit, I'm going to share with the public with all of its exhibits. In any case, quercetin, according to the study here, the program on integrative medicine at the University of North Carolina's School of Medicine was co-authored and reviewed. They reviewed the emerging research on the subject. It also facilitates zinc transportation across lipid membranes. So it's a really good nutrient to have in your arsenal to keep healthy. And also they finally figure out why acupuncture works. This is interesting. This is from the LA Biomed. And the study finds it elevates, guess what, nitric oxide, leading to pain reduction. Let's see. So if you have beets and pomegranate and rhubarb and spinach, other things that create nitric oxide, that increases flow of blood to the brain, to the extremities, helping get more circulation into the calves, helping reduce intermittent claudication, helping protect your heart, helping to heal the arteries, making smoother arteries, less likely to have plaque formation that would break off and cause a stroke or heart attack. But now we can add reducing pain. How about that? And I know a lot of you are getting your nitric oxide every morning. Good for you. One of the smartest things you could do. Now we know why acupuncture works. Works off the same principle. Also, scientists have discovered at Iowa State University, as well as the University of Wisconsin, a new association between the endocannabinoids and exercise to treat depression. Use the two together. This, according to this study, and it makes a huge difference for people to improve their mood if they had depression. This was published in the Journal of Medicine and Sports Exercise. So, oh, and by the way, one last thing from Green Med Info. If you want to cut down on varicose veins, these varicosities and chronic venous insufficiency, you know, those little bulging veins, little purple veins around your ankles and feet and up your thighs, calves, pine bark extract, pycnogenol. So pycnogenol is effective in improving varicose veins. That's good news. And because what you've got chronic venous insufficiency, and that's one of the things when the breakdown in the vein valves, and that's called chronic venous insufficiency. So now you're up to date on everything. And by the way, if you've got multiple sclerosis, according to Oregon State School of Medicine, alpha lipoic acid shows brain protective effects in MS. 1,200 milligrams, that's higher dose. That's your functional dose. And they did it against a placebo for 2 years. Big difference in the improvements. Alpha-lipoic acid. So that's the latest on health and healing. And we're going to have a little break and come right back at you. So we'll be here. We want to give you the latest on empowerment. And what we're going to do when we come back, we're going to go directly to the psychology of obedience and the virtue of disobedience. Please stay with us.
Citizen ever for a moment, or in the least degree, resign his conscience to the legislator? Why has every man a conscience then? I think that we should be men first and subjects afterward. The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do at any time what I think right. These words, penned by Henry David Thoreau in his great work Civil Disobedience, express a sentiment that is all but lost on the majority of people today. In the private sphere, it is normal for people to use their conscience to evaluate the morality of an action. But when it comes to the things demanded of them by their government, unquestioned obedience, with little thought as to the right or wrong of the action, is the norm. In this video, we are going to examine the psychology of obedience, paying particular attention to why people obey those in power, even if it means committing actions that in any other situation they would view as immoral. We will also examine disobedience and how it acts as a crucial counterforce to the rise of an oppressive government. Obedience can be defined as performing an action not because of a personal desire or motive, but because one is commanded to do so by someone in a position of authority. Obedience can be extremely beneficial in certain circumstances, such as in the relationship between a child and parent, or in the adherence to laws which prevent aggressive actions such as assault, theft, or murder. However, in other cases, obedience can result in the most brutal of outcomes. Even a cursory glance at history, wrote Arthur Koestler, should convince one that individual crimes committed for selfish motives play a quite insignificant part in the human tragedy, compared to the numbers massacred in unselfish loyalty to one's tribe, nation, dynasty, church, or political ideology. What this sad fact of history suggests is that humans have a strong tendency to obey those in positions of power. Sigmund Freud recognized this, stating that we should never underestimate the power of the need to obey. Like most of our defining characteristics, this need to obey is part instinctual. Stretching deep into our evolutionary past, many of the ancestors of Homo sapiens organized themselves according to ranking systems, or what are called dominance hierarchies. Survival in a dominance hierarchy requires the ability to make distinctions between rank and recognition of the permitted and forbidden actions based on one's rank. Failure in either of these respects can lead to death or being cast out from one's group, and therefore those who display such traits are more likely to survive and pass on their genes. But while the influence of dominance hierarchies in our evolutionary history can help explain the human tendency to obey, it does not fully explain why people obey even when the actions demanded of them are clearly immoral or to the detriment of their own survival. For example, looking back at the brutal reign of Stalin in Russia or the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, why did those who lived during these times remain obedient to the point of committing the most brutal of actions, including the murder and torture of completely innocent people en masse? It may be tempting to suggest that most people are complicit in tyranny due to fear. However, while this is true to a degree, fear alone cannot account for the fact that many people do not recognize or acknowledge the injustice of their own government even when they are living under tyranny. As Don Mixon in his book Obedience and Civilization explains, we may be genuinely puzzled as to how people could obey commands that seem both bloodthirsty and stupid. Puzzlement can vanish when we realize that in the eyes of their perpetrators, the hideous crimes of history are not hideous crimes at all, but acts of loyalty, patriotism, and duty. From the vantage point of the present, we can see them as hideous crimes. But ordinarily from that same vantage point, we cannot see the crimes of our own governments as hideous or even as crimes. Michael Humer, in his book The Problem of Political Authority, suggests that the existence of certain cognitive biases can help account for this inability to recognize the injustice of one's own government. One of the most prevalent of these biases is the psychological phenomenon known as cognitive dissonance, as Humer explains. According to this widely accepted theory, we experience an uncomfortable state known as cognitive dissonance when we have two or more cognitions that stand in conflict or tension with one another, and particularly when our behavior or other reactions appear to conflict with our self-image. We then tend to alter our beliefs or reactions to reduce the dissonance. For instance, a person who sees himself as compassionate yet finds himself inflicting pain on others will experience cognitive dissonance. He might reduce this dissonance by ceasing to inflict pain, changing his image of himself, or adopting auxiliary beliefs to explain why a compassionate person may inflict pain in this situation. The existence of an oppressive government produces many situations where dissonance can arise, as people are frequently required to take actions which conflict with their personal beliefs of right and wrong and their images of themselves as good people. An extremely common trigger for dissonance in the modern day arises from the requirement to pay taxes to fund government activities which involve things that one views as unethical. Examples could include the caging of drug users, the bailing out of crony capitalists, the fighting of wars, or the mass surveillance of one's own citizenry. In other words, paying taxes, along with the knowledge that this money is being used to fund programs and activities which one sees as immoral, can generate cognitive dissonance. To deal with this dissonance, some people will change their beliefs regarding the beneficence and necessity of a centralized state. But a more common way to quell this dissonance is to adopt justifications to excuse these government actions, or to avoid sources of information which trigger awareness of the immorality stemming from their own government. In addition to cognitive dissonance, another psychological bias which contributes to the human willingness to obey even a tyrannical government is the status quo bias, which is the powerful tendency to see the beliefs of one's own society as obviously true, and the practices of one's own society as obviously right and good, regardless of what those beliefs and practices are. The need to be accepted, the powerful drive to conform, as well as heavy doses of indoctrination all promote the status quo bias. As Humer explains, government is an extremely prominent and fundamental feature of the structure of our society. We know that people tend to have a powerful bias in favor of the existing arrangements of their own societies. It therefore stands to reason that, whether or not any government were legitimate, most of us would have a strong tendency to believe that some governments are legitimate, especially our own and others like it. It is thus not surprising that so many people unquestioningly obey government commands, no matter how oppressive or tyrannical they become, when one accounts for the cognitive biases and evolved tendencies of man. In fact, Don Mixon went so far as to write, "Obedience that occurs in a hierarchical social structure needs no special explanation. However, disobedience in the same circumstances does need explaining." In the remainder of this video, we will look at what promotes the likelihood of disobedience in response to tyranny. The first thing to note is that clearly people will not refuse to commit immoral acts unless they overcome the biases which promote unquestioned obedience to the state. Self-education and ridding oneself of the false beliefs that result from years of indoctrination and excessive propaganda is crucial. Only by doing this can we loosen the grip which pernicious ideologies have on our minds and instead, as Thoreau recommended, use our own conscience to evaluate the right or wrong of an action. People are also more likely to disobey the tyrannical commands of those in power if they lose confidence in the capability of their rulers. This could potentially happen if increasing numbers of people came to realize that societies are far too complex for centralized government control to be effective. However, loss in confidence is more likely to arise due to the sheer ineptitude of politicians, which makes it increasingly difficult for people to place any faith in existing government institutions. An additional factor, especially relevant these days, which impacts disobedience relates to the degree of surveillance in a society. In Obedience and Civilization, Don Mixon points out that mass surveillance greatly diminishes the likelihood of disobedience, as it creates a situation analogous to that faced by a devout religious believer who censors his thoughts and behaviors due to the all-seeing eye of God. Gods, of course, are frequently described as being both omniscient and omnipotent, and it is not difficult to see why. If believers can be brought truly to believe that their God can see into their minds and hearts, and to believe that he will punish them severely if he glimpses the slightest disloyalty, they may be persuaded to change their thinking and their feeling and become, internally and externally, more compliant and more obedient. For what must be overcome, the chief obstacle in the way of command hierarchies reaching their ideal typical form is the human power to lie, pretend, and assimilate. Citizens who have the ability to pretend loyalty and love while plotting disobedience and treason are serious threats to the security of any power that be. Only if people can be persuaded that their efforts to lie and pretend are rendered fruitless by an all-seeing eye can obedience become assured. Societies which accept the need for mass surveillance or allow it to spread through non-action and compliance are societies which become increasingly unable to resist tyranny. Totalitarian regimes of the 20th century clearly recognized this, as they all instituted forms of mass surveillance on their citizenry. However, modern technology has created surveillance capabilities that dictators, such as Hitler and Stalin, could only have dreamt of. As these technologies are put to use, a prison of the mind, so to speak, will be constructed. Realizing that so much of one's life is being monitored, the surveillance capabilities of governments, like an all-seeing eye of God, will make thoughts and behaviors favoring compliance and conformity the norm. While the tendency to obey is certainly a prominent feature of man, there are always a brave few who, in the face of corrupt power, are willing to stand up and refuse. Those with the courage to disobey are not only protectors of freedom, but, as Eric Fromm suggested, individuals who move a society forward. Man has continued to evolve by acts of disobedience. Not only was his spiritual development possible only because there were men who dared to say no to the powers that be, in the name of their conscience or their faith, but also his intellectual development was dependent on the capacity for being disobedient. Disobedient to authorities who tried to muzzle new thoughts, and to the authority of long-established opinions which declared a change to be nonsense.
Okay. A lot to think about there. Let's unwrap some of that. From my own personal perspective, I have seen more change come when we have been patient enough to share a positive message of what is not working with the existing system and what will work with a counter system. Let me give you an example. If someone has obesity and I ask, would you like to know what the downside of obesity is? And then I start telling them 100 things and how easy it would be to change from a downside to an upside, where they can live a longer life and fit into all their clothes, not have depression, and not have any body shaming and all the other things that go through someone's mind when they're overweight. Suddenly you have more interest in saying, yeah, that makes sense. Right now we're faced with at least 5 major bubbles all bursting. And by them bursting, we have to make change or we'll be swept away. Now a person is saying, what options do I have? And that's where we then can go forward in a gentle way and suggest, get off the grid. You're being disobedient. You're not using their credit cards. You're not running up 30% interest on each credit card. Remember, when you're delinquent on one credit card, all your credit cards automatically go delinquent at a high rate of interest. We say no to voting for any politician that supports the military-industrial complex, which, by the way, is the entirety, almost 90% of all Democrat and Republicans right now. We all say no to no intervention around the world. We say yes. Wouldn't it make sense if we sent ambassadors of peace and forgiveness and conciliation to every country in the world to remend what we have broken, to show them we are not to be feared, but rather to be respected? And so we take a different approach, completely different approach, having nothing to do with the neocons. Someone's going, yeah. Would you rather be at war with China and Russia, which is unwinnable by the United States? We can't even win against a bunch of people, you know, with old rifles in Afghanistan after, you know, 17 years. Do you really think that we're going to win against two of the greatest armies in the world with all the technology and nuclear weapons? No, of course not. You'd have to be completely delusional. Well, then why not seek peace with them? Under what terms would we be at peace, providing that that we live to our standards of equality, inclusiveness, but so do they, which means in China, stop rounding up Muslims, over 1 million, and put them into internment camps, stop with the Uyghurs, and stop with the Falun Gong and using over 10 million of them for their organs. You know, you stop it or we don't do anything with you. You know, and you can go around the countries and say, we're willing to work with you in peace. No military attaches, but diplomats, real diplomats. And we have a lot of good career diplomats. So you see, you have to have an alternative to what a person believes in that is reasonable and responsible in some evidence. That's by showing them documentaries and giving them articles. That's why I'm always producing and with my team, Richard Gale and Valerie and Rolla Marconi, we're producing documentaries all the time. These are documentaries to enlighten, to expand, to break through people's consciousness. You can't break through someone's consciousness by breaking into their house, by burning down their business, by calling them names, by insulting them, and by turning your back and giving the finger. That doesn't open up dialogue that's constructive. I'm sure that in time, in another 10 years, people will look back on our actions and say, wow, where is the sensitivity to respecting people who were different from them? So remember this, when you're judging someone, judge them based upon the environment and culture and conditioning they grew up in, and what did they do in spite of that to change and make it a better world. The article today is entitled The Failures of the Revolution to Erase Racism from the National Consciousness. It'll be posted in about an hour. Today, we are not only witnessing a serious challenge to the ethics of social inclusiveness, but also threats to past generational values in general. For example, the post-war baby boomers, who inspired the idea of a nonviolent protest from Martin Luther King and Gandhi, and the revolution against, for example, the British rule in India, or racism in much of the South of the United States. These are two among many historical figures who were perceived as mentors and visionaries for radical nonviolent revolutionary change. King and Gandhi led united efforts that were extraordinarily inclusive and did not demand rights of any class, caste, or race over another. There's no identity politics. Yes, there were ardent racists and white supremacists opposing King and Hindu fundamentalist factions who opposed Gandhi. Nobody can please everybody, but the vast majority supported their protest movements, and that's why change occurred. We might also note several of the founding fathers, such as Washington Jefferson, later Abraham Lincoln, who created the political conditions that gave birth to the Emancipation Proclamation. And yet today, all three of these people were vilified, statues removed, defaced, and their entire reputations destroyed, to be expunged from history as if they played no role that was constructive. They just owned slaves, or in the case of Lincoln, what was it? A statue that he had nothing to do with? This is reaction. This is the mob reaction. This is not reason. However, today this historical legacy is being jeopardized. Monuments are being destroyed. Book burnings are attempting to purge the memory of past tyrants, real and imagined, from the national consciousness. Yes, we should continue to construct statues and memorials in every state, I believe, based upon what would be perceived as the most conscientious, positive persons from a state whose actions, sacrifices, and deeds allowed something in the way of progress going forward for all people in that state. And then we should have a national monument center in Washington, D.C., where the likes of George Washington Carver, Paul Robeson, Dorothy Day, Cesar Chavez, Rosa Parks, Harriet Jacobs, and Native American leaders such as Chief Seattle and Chief Joseph. And those are among a few of the thousands that we should have, each one with a story of what they contributed, what sacrifices they made. Not because these people were perfect, none were, but because their sacrifices were the dominant issue of their legacy. These are individuals who exceeded their social and ethnic biases to become a voice for the voiceless during moments of history that needed to give the persecuted and oppressed hope. But before we start tearing down monuments, are we collectively capable of using reason instead of brute emotional reactions to discern the real symbolic significance in these acts? Revolutions destroy repressive symbols from the past. After Ukraine severed ties with Russia in 2014, Ukrainians went on a frenzy to raise earlier Soviet statues. Many statues of Stalin were removed after the Soviet Union collapsed. During the recent Black Lives Matter demonstrations, dozens of Confederate monuments have been removed by city and county ordinances. Protesters have toppled busts and statues of Robert E. Lee, Alfred Pike, Jefferson Davis, Confederate grave markers, the Friar Sierra, who was responsible for enslaving many Native Americans in Spanish missions in the Southwest, to either convert or to savagely punish them. Dozens of Christopher Columbus statues have been either upset or removed. We can find sound reason for the removal of these historical figures. I've been saying this for a long time. You should put in place of every Christopher Columbus statue one of the noted, and there are many, the Native Americans who were the first, the indigenous groups who were here. When the city of San Francisco removed the bust of white supremacist and Nazi sympathizer Avery Brundage, who expelled Tommy Smith and John Carlos from the 1968 Summer Olympics for raising black glove fists on the award podium, we can find that justifiable, that he should not be in memory on a good issue. He had a bad issue. Those who stood in solidarity, that was positive. But for other monuments and symbols that have been of similar fate, historical amnesia and the sheer hysteria of vandalism trump reason. We should stop before we act unilaterally and have a collective discussion with scholars, historians who are not biased, to tell us what did Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Francis Scott Key, General Ulysses Grant, and the Unionist abolitionist Colonel Hans Christian Hegg do. Although Grant did own a slave that was gifted to him, the general released him, and after the war he would go on to prosecute the Ku Klux Klan. And he appointed the largest number of African Americans into important roles in his administration of any president up to that point. That's worthy of commemoration. But do you not know that part of history? Do you not know that part of his legacy? Do you not know that he led the Union Army? By the way, the original person who was asked to lead the army was Ulysses, Robert E. Lee. And Robert E. Lee chose not to because of where he lived in Virginia. In any case, so you have to look at, there would still be slavery if there was not Lincoln and Grant. So we would have no freedoms today to be challenging what had happened historically or those people who target people based upon their color, those within the police or those within the Justice Department, those within the Attorney General's office, those within the judiciary, those within the prison system itself. You would have none of those rights. So should we not look at the full picture? We would not have a united country today if it wasn't for George Washington. We would not have had the support of France if it weren't for Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin. We would not be a united country today. We would have had no United States. There would have been no winning to the revolution if it weren't for these people. Does that not count? Evidently not. Then by what measure are you judging someone? If that is the measure that you're judging someone, if they've ever done anything wrong, irrespective of the environment which they grew up, the condition they grew up, things that were wrong that were accepted as okay until more enlightened minds and challenging minds and disobedient minds reminded them, the fact that you're doing something doesn't mean it's right. Your heritage is wrong. So by that measure, Martin Luther King would not be anything today because of his infidelity, which was rampant. But do we hold that against him? Do we look at what a person achieves? That's a conversation we need to have prior to tearing down all of those statues and erasing them from history as if they were irrelevant, as if history started yesterday because we were woke to yesterday. And by that measure, will we condemn someone because of that indiscretion and overlook anything else they did that allowed us to be here today? So those caught in the frenzy of expunging the past also forget that no one is perfect. Washington Jefferson certainly had their foibles, but they also are products of a culture in their time, and their deeds of integrity need to be weighed against their faults and failures. And in this regard, they too are deserving to be considered before being destroyed. Even Lincoln is now being expunged as if somehow he was a racist, and that he was the one who was the principal behind the Emancipation Proclamation. All subsequent acts that eventually led to the end of slavery can be traced back through a chain of cause and effect to the signers of the Declaration of Independence, establishing the nation as a democracy that was wary of big government. And to this woman who has this professor, who has this best-selling book, claiming that all whites are racist. That is so racist. That is so stupid. That is so vile. That is so intellectually dishonest. And yet it matches the need of those who want to perceive that as a reality. Then what do you do? Do you realize what you do when you claim that every white person is evil, bad, must be destroyed, or is, well, think of the consequences. But for a reminder, for those of you who actually care about history, 2 million men, about 90% who were white, fought for the Union during the Civil War to keep the country united and to overthrow the South slave culture. And few realize that approximately 25% of those whites were foreigners. How many gave up their livelihoods and including their lives for this cause? Despite the Crown, King George III's targeting the colonists for arrest and confiscation of their properties and execution, which they did to many of the signers' Declaration of Independence, they continued the revolution and went head to head in combat against the world's most formidable military. Revolutions, right or wrong, are efforts to erase injustices in the present that are based upon and persist from injustices in the past. Yet the saying, the pull of the future is greater than the push from the past, implies that history is nothing less than a trajectory of constant uncertain change. Conservative sentiments and nostalgia for a return to the times past are illusions. The Trump mantra of make America great again is a fantasy, since in the present's infinite ignorance, he believes we can return to the days of the industrial empires of Rockefeller and Carnegie and Vanderbilt and J.P. Morgan by deregulating and giving free taxpayer handouts to the mega corporations on Wall Street. Forget environmental protections and the conservation reserves. If there is private corporate profit to be gained from the land and soil, they will exploit it. We don't speak about the Trump administration toppling, trashing, and desecrating our national parks for conglomerates of miners and fossil fuel extractors, which are as much a part of our history as the founding fathers and those who fought on their behalf of abolition. The current protests warrant our support for their legitimacy if they're nonviolent, on systemic racial prejudices, but it's not just a few of the percentage of the police that continue to plague the U.S. Unfortunately, wisdom is solely lacking. Like many revolutions that get out of hand when the fiery passions of over-emotional mobs dominate intellectual understanding, tyranny is replaced with new forms of repression, physical and psychological. Word think, don't say that, don't speak that, because it's not in alignment with what our new true word things should be. Well, then you're using censorship. Then we no longer are a free society. Our amendment, the First Amendment, freedom of speech, worship, and assembly is no longer guaranteed because those in power dictate that they are replacing what they consider tyranny with their own. Today, the legacy of Gandhi has been nearly forgotten in Modi's India. Statues of Gandhi have been removed by revolutionary Hindu nationalists and replaced by images of his assassins. Entire brigades of Hindu nationalist youth scour the countryside to ridicule and publicly shame those who still hold to Gandhian ideas in ways not dissimilar to Mao Zedong's culture revolution of Red Guard youth in the 1960s, destroying and killing and imprisoning in re-education camps all intellectuals, all free thinkers, all those who would disobey, all those who were dissident. Revolutions, therefore, can always and always do have their dark side. Unfortunately, the demonstrations underway are missing so many of the crucial factors that have institutionalized racism. It goes well beyond Confederate memorials and books assigned in classrooms. The revolution underway must include our entire judiciary system. Go back to Eric Holter and before then, and beyond local law enforcement. Our entire prison system is corrupt and racist. Our entire sentencing system, our debt peonage system by lenders and debtors, prisons, is utterly corrupt and unconstitutional. And these judicial structures of injustice were created by our politicians. None of us ever had a vote as to whether we approve of the private interests that have hijacked American justice or not. The Clintons, the Bushes, the Obamas, the Trumps, and of course the Bidens and their supporters have all been party to the immoral lawlessness in our courts. Unless our entire 100% of our judicial system is completely dismantled and reformed, there will never be any racial justice, social or economic equality, or accountability for law enforcement in this nation. To think and act otherwise is simply an illusion. That is the end of that commentary. Tomorrow, for those who would vote for, you would vote again for Obama. He would be president in a heartbeat, and people would pride themselves on that. I want you to think of this, because these are accurate, and we need to remember that people should be held accountable. Libya. 40,000 Americans died. Obama's responsible. 9,700 airstrikes, 7,700 precision-guided bombs dropped on Libya, all also phosphorus bombs and all with depleted uranium. Afghanistan, 40,000 civilians killed during Obama years. And although civilian deaths reached its highest under Trump this 2 years ago, Iraq, 92,600 documented civilian deaths during Obama's 8 years. There were one, Obama sent 1,878 drone strikes, killing 3,100 non-combatants, 7,500 civilians killed. In Yemen, over 100,000 killed since the conflict, and that was started by Obama supporting Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. In Somalia, U.S. military intervention in Somalia began right through the Obama. And then you have to look at the synthetic opiate deaths were the highest during Obama, 67,000 in 1 year alone, but nothing done to quell that. Add all the deaths up. It's over 267,000 deaths that didn't have to happen, happened under Obama, and all the people of color. So what do you call that? Is that wiped away? Is that the way that we react today? That we will challenge someone from 200 years ago, and possibly rightly so, but we will not challenge genocidalists, we will not challenge racism, we will not challenge the systemic destruction of other governments, other countries, until we have our geopolitical needs met by having them either be an abundant source of their natural resources for the United States to exploit and our corporations, or we kill them. So that's all forgotten. Seven regimes that were toppled, and including in Venezuela, we were behind all that. So you see, once you open that door to being hypercritical and unilateral, take a closer look at home. We've been this way for a long time. And behind this is not race. Behind this is power. And until we deal with the power and hegemony and imperialism and neoliberalism and deal with it honestly by withdrawing our support from it, then the people who are running rampant in the streets today, peacefully or not, those people now have been captured by the very people, without realizing it, that they're against. And that is the neoliberalists who control everything. by all the institutions and all the media. People are being played again. Righteous indignation, yes, but look beyond the cop. Look beyond the prosecuting attorney. Look beyond the U.S. attorney. Look beyond the judges. Look beyond the Justice Department. Look beyond the FBI. Look at the CIA. Look at all these other agencies and major operators. Those are the deep state. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening and have a nice day.